Bellevue is America's oldest public hospital. It has weathered every disease and public health scare that's passed through New York City and developed a certain notoriety along the way. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Oshinsky has taken a fresh look at its history in his latest book, Bellevue, Three Centuries of Medicine and Mayhem at America's Most Storied Hospital, which takes us beyond the hospital's infamous psychiatric wards to spotlight its role in the development of American medicine from the first ambulance fleet to the beginnings of medical photography. The book is published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased it has brought David Oshinsky back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
When did Bellevue open?
Bellevue opened in 1736.
And what did it look like then? Obviously not like the hospital we know today.
No, it was simply part of the land that was known as the Bellevue Estate. And it was basically for victims of infectious disease like yellow fever.
Was there anything about that area, the east side of Manhattan, that made it an attractive spot for a public hospital?
Yes, it was very isolated. You have to picture a New York City where virtually everyone lived down by the Battery. And therefore, when you had an infectious disease like yellow fever, which was a killer, what you wanted was a place that was at least 2 or 3 miles from the city center.
And you begin your story with a man named James Jackson.
Right.
He had yellow fever?
He did. He was an Irish immigrant, and he was actually, his remains were removed during a reclamation project in Washington Square around 2010. And the reason was that Washington Square was really the first potter's field in New York City, and it was used as a mass grave for the burial of people with infectious disease.
He was unusual in that he most likely died at home. Where did the less fortunate victims of yellow fever go?
They went to Bellevue. In other words, they were taken by cart or by boat, and they were simply dumped at Bellevue. It was a place to die.
And how was the hospital staffed at that time?
It was staffed by really one physician named Alexander Anderson, who was this remarkable young man who went there because he believed that God had sent him there to do the work of the church. And he stayed during the yellow fever epidemic as his son, his wife, both his parents, and his brother died from the disease. And he was really this sort of courageous, passionate physician that really starts to me the trend at Bellevue Hospital.
And didn't catch it himself.
He did not. It's quite amazing. I mean, he was just very, very lucky. The insect did not bite him.
What sort of training did the staff have in those days? What was the standard treatment for a yellow fever patient?
Unfortunately, it was pretty much bleeding and purging. This was a time when medicine had not advanced into what we know as antiseptic surgery, all of antibiotics and things that we take for granted today. It was very primitive. And therefore, what you tried to do and what Alexander Anderson tried to do was just to keep these patients comfortable.
But by bleeding them, although it is interesting that leeches have been reintroduced into medical practice recently.
Right. Well, the great Dr. Rush, who was one of our founding fathers, was a great believer in bleeding and purging. And that, if you went to medical school in those days, and few did, that was one of the things you did learn.
Anywhere in the world, would the practice have been different in Britain?
No, it would have been exactly the same in Great Britain. Most of the physicians in this era were very much like craftsmen. They just studied with another physician for a certain number of years and then began to take on their own patients.
The treatment of George Washington in 1799 was an extreme example of the medical philosophy of the day. How was he treated?
He was treated the same way. He had a very, very bad throat infection that may have killed him anyway. But what we do know was that he was bled and purged and bled and purged until he finally said, "Let me go," and they did.
And people didn't realize that this was not working?
No, they believed that if you could purge the bad humors.
Purging meant forcing people to throw up?
Yes, in very, very violent ways, and bleeding them. It was simply a way they thought of cleansing the body.
How were doctors learning about the human body at the time? Was anatomical dissection practiced at the end of the 18th century?
It was practiced. The problem was there were very, very few bodies to practice on, and therefore virtually all of the young, better physicians in New York City were grave robbers.
How did the public react to learning that doctors were digging up and dissecting bodies from New York City's cemeteries? It could have been a loved one.
Well, you're absolutely right. There was, in fact, what was called the Doctors' Riot of 1788. It was the biggest crowd in the history of the city. 5,000 people descended on the jail where some doctor grave robbers were being held, and they were yelling, "Give us your doctors, give us your doctors." And basically the cream of New York City, you know, some of the most famous politicians of that time, basically held them off at the jail and used the militia to fire upon them. So, to put it mildly, it wasn't looked upon well.
And then, for some reason, yellow fever abates?
It does.
And then we have another epidemic, cholera.
Yes, cholera is probably brought to the United States by Irish immigrants. It was a relatively modern disease in Europe, and it comes across in the 1830s, basically on the famine ships of poor Irish going to Canada, to Boston, to New York City.
A leading theory on the cause of many diseases, including cholera, was the miasma theory.
That is correct.
What was that?
It was simply that there were clouds of bad air, and these clouds moved over cities, and when they descended, they brought all kinds of diseases with them.
And the clouds were generally brought by poor people?
Well, that's the problem. Obviously, if you looked at this scientifically, you would figure that some people are getting this in larger numbers than other people, and since the entire city lives under the clouds, it would take a while. And there was a very, very famous British physician named John Snow who finally figured out that cholera came from a bacterium in the water and not from bad clouds of air.
And how long before that was dealt with? Because we still see cholera outbreaks. We had one in Haiti not long ago.
We do. Cholera today is a disease that is rare in the United States. If someone were to get it, you would just keep the person hydrated and give the person antibiotics, and that would be the end of it. But when you have an earthquake that destroys a sewer system and destroys a water system, and when you have soldiers coming from other areas, from the UN, you know, trying to help out, but actually having toilet pits that are very close to the rivers in Haiti, you're going to have a problem, and they did.
My guest is David Oshinsky, whose latest book is Bellevue, Three Centuries of Medicine and Mayhem at America's Most Storied Hospital. How prepared was Bellevue to handle the cholera epidemic of the 1830s?
It was very unprepared. It had very, very few doctors, and the nurses were called 10-day women. They were simply women who were serving a 10-day sentence in local prisons for prostitution or something like that. So Bellevue was completely unaware of what caused the disease, but what it did was to allow them to experiment on many of these patients. For doctors, one of the beauties of Bellevue was that you had uncomplaining patients. In other words, they were there, and you could pretty much do what you wanted.
And you could staff it with prostitutes, because if they get sick, they're going to die.
That is exactly right.
During that time, did the wider New York City community have an idea of what was going on at Bellevue? What was its view of Bellevue?
I would say that everybody in the city knew of Bellevue, but very, very early on, it became the hospital that turned no one away, the hospital of last resort, the hospital of immigrants, new immigrants who came. And that really was its station. That was what it was set up to do, and it did it very, very well.
But at that time, there was the idea that there were deserving patients and undeserving patients.
Correct. A deserving patient might go to New York Hospital. That was the other early hospital, and it was what you'd call a voluntary hospital. It wasn't a city hospital. It had a bunch of charitable donors, and what these donors would often do would be to have their own workmen go to the hospital if they needed help. But if you were unattached, if it was clear you were going to die, if no one was going to take care of you, Bellevue was the place you were sent.
And if New York Hospital wanted to get rid of a patient, they would send him over to Bellevue?
They certainly would.
Okay, so now we have cholera. Now that abates as well. Do we have any idea why?
Yes, we do have a very good idea why. Until about the 1830s, New York City's water supply were basically very shallow wells, and these wells could be very easily polluted by fecal waste. And it was really because of cholera that we began to take water down from the Croton and other places in Westchester and bring it to big reservoirs in New York City.
So along comes typhus.
Yes, typhus is next.
When was that?
Typhus really comes to New York City in the 1850s, and it also probably comes through the body louse that is attached to immigrants on various ships. And it's a very, very deadly disease.
Since Bellevue was a kind of a quarantine place, had the city grown enough so that it was less isolated?
That's a very good question. The answer is no. The city began to grow around Bellevue, and there really were issues. So the biggest quarantine hospitals were now, after you went to Bellevue, you might go to a quarantine hospital in Staten Island or in one of the East River Islands.
But actually, Bellevue starts doing serious medicine around this time.
It does. One of the really remarkable things about Bellevue is that it's treating what you would call the lowest elements of society, those who have no other options. But at the same time, it's attracting some of the best medical minds in the country. And I think there are two reasons for this. One is that physicians at this time did believe it was their Christian duty to help the poor. And Bellevue was also, by this point, the largest public hospital in the United States. And if you were a physician, you would see everything at Bellevue.
But weren't certain groups not at Bellevue, Jews and Italians most notably?
They would come later. The Irish came first, then the Germans came, but the Germans wanted very little to do with Bellevue, so they started their own hospital, actually called Germans Hospital, which is now Lenox Hill Hospital. But when the big Jewish-Italian immigration began in the 1890s, what you begin to see are Jewish and Italian names, Cohen and Rossi, replacing O'Brien and O'Rourke.
It seems that the hospital was constantly in a state of emergency, first yellow fever, then typhus, and then the Civil War. You posed the question, is war good for medicine? And do you have an answer?
Well, the answer in a technical sense is yes. Basically, so many medical inventions and so much medical progress has come through war, whether it's nursing, trauma treatment, ambulances, a separation of groups who have various diseases. So in a sense, a lot was learned, and particularly in surgery, an awful lot was learned during the Civil War.
But you also mentioned ambulances. This is when civilian ambulances first began to be used?
That is right. Bellevue had the first civilian ambulance corps, and it comes right out of the Civil War. It was a Bellevue physician who went into the service and saw these big gut-busting ambulances taking soldiers off the field in Antietam and Gettysburg, and realized that this could easily be duplicated in New York City. You just needed a smaller, quicker ambulance that could move through traffic.
They were still horse-drawn.
All horse-drawn.
The hospital's ambulance teams competed for the fastest response times.
They did. And they were damn fast. I mean, you could traverse a half mile in just over 2 minutes, you know, crossing over railroad tracks and going through underpasses and the like. These drivers were generally immigrants, generally Irish. They knew their horses well, and they could really move.
Bellevue was also home of medical photography. What prompted doctors to begin photographing their patients?
There was a man named O.G. Mason who really starts it, and he is one of, in a sense, the unknown heroes of this book. And what Mason started to do, which really to get the money for all of this, was that he would photograph every single corpse that came into Bellevue. Now, at Bellevue, you had basically 48 hours to either bury the person or the person wound up on an anatomy slab at a medical school or in Potter's Field. But what O.G. Mason did was to post the picture of the headshot of every single corpse that went through Bellevue so that families that couldn't be there in 48 hours would generally have the opportunity to go to Potter's Field and rebury the dead, and they charged a dollar apiece for these. So it really used that money. And it also began kind of the mug shots used by the New York City police force.
I remember some years back talking to someone who had just gone through medical school, and he told me that graduating doctors compete to get into hospitals like Bellevue in Kings County. They prefer them to the fancy hospitals. Was this already happening in the 19th century?
This was. I mean, you had some of the most famous medical minds, William Welsh, William Halsted, the great surgeon, basically wanting to go to Bellevue. Walter Reed of yellow fever fame, Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin of polio vaccine fame, all wanted to come to Bellevue and NYU Medical School.
Was Bellevue onto all of the most modern thinking, like when Joseph Lister published his paper in The Lancet about germ theory and being and using antiseptic methods?
I would say the answer is a qualified yes. It was kind of a generational split between the younger physicians who wanted antiseptic medicine and the older physicians who wanted to keep what they had.
Well, if Moore had thought along those lines, we might have had President James Garfield live longer. He could have been one of the greatest presidents we ever had.
That is very possible. As you know, Garfield was shot by an assassin twice, and it was the great Bellevue surgeon Frank Hamilton who was among those who was sent down to Washington to deal with the wounds. And what Hamilton did was to stick his dirty finger and dirty probes into Garfield's wounds. We know today that if Garfield had just been left alone, he would have survived.
He was trying to get the bullets out.
He was, and he was looking for fragments. And what he did was simply to cause massive infection.
When did Bellevue become synonymous with psychiatric problems? Often, somebody was acting up, we're going to send you to Bellevue.
When I was a kid, if your mother thought you were acting weirdly, you're on your way to Bellevue. There was a woman named Nellie Bly. Nellie Bly was one of these whirlwind reporters who worked for Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. She was a person who went around the world in 76 days after Jules Verne said it could be done in 80 days. And what she did was to get herself, she acted quote-unquote crazy and got herself sent to Bellevue. And then she published this huge expose about the hospital called 10 Days in a Madhouse. And I think that was really the precursor.
And it lasted for a long time. Lennon's assassin, Mark David Chapman, was sent to Bellevue after he was arrested.
That is absolutely true. And John Lennon's body rested in the Bellevue morgue very, very close by. But, you know, one of the things is that Bellevue is so close to Greenwich Village that so many of the writers went through there, you know, at one point or another wrote about it with Norman Mailer, Allen Ginsberg, Delmore Schwartz. It was really, really a lineup of very, very famous people who wrote about Bellevue and added to the madhouse notion.
In 1956, you write, the Nobel Prize came to Bellevue. Why did it earn the Nobel Prize?
Well, there were two researchers, Richards and Cournand, who figured out how to use cardiac catheterization. And basically what they did, they ran the chest ward at Bellevue. And what they were really looking to do was to see whether lungs and heart were of one circulatory system. And they figured this out using a catheter that went right to the heart. And they were really remarkable scientists. And they were the type of people who were attracted to Bellevue.
On the other hand, lobotomies and electroshock therapy were used in the mental hospital, but Bellevue also became the place of last resort with the AIDS crisis and then Ebola later. Right now, I assume it's considered one of the great hospitals of the world.
It is. When that one Ebola patient was found in New York City, Bellevue was the place. More patients died of AIDS and was serviced by doctors at Bellevue. It's one of the great heroic stories of modern medicine.
David Oshinsky is a professor in the Department of History at New York University, director of the Division of Medical Humanities at NYU Langone Medical Center. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner. His book, Bellevue, is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.